Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. And that is Love is a Tricky Thing from Julie Feeney. And tonight, it being Sunday, the night we sometimes invite someone in to pick the tracks. I'm delighted to say that Julie Feeney joins me in the studio. Julie, great to see you.
Brilliant to see you. I'm delighted to be here.
I haven't seen you in such a while. I'm tempted to ask, where have you been?
Yeah, I've been still on the planet, but I've been inhabiting a very different world, which has acted like a kind of a stopper of me on my treadmill, hamster treadmill, you know, making my three albums and doing shows and blah, 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 blah. So I've just been spending time on family matters. And I mean, my writing, I don't think that I had anything to say before. I don't know why. I don't know how I even made albums before, because I feel now I've actually something to say.
Oh, well, let's talk about that in a minute.
Well, hopefully I'll say it on the actual things.
I'll let you get settled first before we start talking about that. But so you're back in the saddle, are you?
Yes, I'm hoping to record in September.
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So you're going to pick tunes tonight, and I just know from knowing you over the years that the choices of music will be wide-ranging and marvellous. No question.
Wide-ranging and?
Marvellous.
Oh, marvellous.
Full of marvel.
Marvelosity. Like, it was extremely difficult to come up with a list, so I did completely wreck your poor producer's head.
Finding the things. Not to worry. Now, first choice?
Carl Hayden.
Fiddle tunes.
I mean, he's currently definitely my favourite fiddler.
And he's from Tyrone, you know.
He is. He's just a remarkable musician. Just adore everything he does.
And was trad your first love, was it?
Funnily enough, it's in my blood. It's in both sides. When I went to UCC, I realised that I had been a bit of an academic trad player before then, and I had played sort of trad. But so when I went to UCC, it was just a reawakening inside me. And funnily enough, I think the trad is... such a complex dance music is so complex, so interesting. I think an awful lot of my composition actually is rooted from there, curiously.
Really?
Enough. Yeah, I mean, I feel that there's the fabric, a tune is just such an interesting thing. The phrasing, what's under the undercurrent, the expectation that's set up in the phrase and where you get that expectation. I absolutely find it fascinating.
And was there trad music in the house or in the family, was there?
We were a very sort of schoolhouse. Like, you know, my mother brought us for lessons in absolutely everything. So there weren't like sessions or anything like that. It was all very early to bed kind of thing. But we all played, and I played every instrument under the sun. But there wasn't, you know, like people in playing at night, that kind of thing. There would have been in the previous generation a lot of trad players actually in the family. But because when you go off and you learn piano and then you learn clarinet and violin and all that, you need to be hearing it all the time. So, I mean, I think I probably didn't start playing trad properly early enough. So I absorbed it into my composition, and people find that hard to kind of believe, but it's actually really
well, it's
there.
It's in the DNA, is it? Or it's in the blood.
Definitely. With composition, it's such an interesting music.
Okay, well, here's Cathal Hayden. I think he's playing with Artie McLean here. Some extraordinary playing there from Cathal Hayden with Artie McLean, recorded live in Belfast, the boys of Ballysadare, Tommy Cones and Lord MacDonald's Reels. First choice of Julie Feeney, who's with me in studio tonight.
You know something? I mean, I know Cathal Hayden and I've never taken him for granted, but there are musicians like Cathal Hayden all over this country and they are taken for granted, aren't they? I mean, that's kind of, that's extraordinary.
That's
really
extraordinary playing. He's an extraordinary player, without a question of a doubt. The intricacy within each of the little moments along the line, along the phrase, he's just remarkable.
And you can analyse that because of your academic and your classical background. You can analyse that, give it an added kind of analysis, I guess. I mean, anybody would tap their foot to that. Anybody would be impressed. Anybody would go, "Whoa, that guy's amazing." But you can actually get inside it a bit more, maybe.
Well, I mean, I did a lot of that through study, but it doesn't matter a fig about having all these models.
You can just what you were going to say there for a minute.
You can find all of those models, you know, Retty, Keller, all the different ones. Keller is one that I really love, but still love.
What does that mean?
It's about setting up a background that there's something implied. This is putting it very crudely. There's a background implied, and that the tension or the interest or the thing that draws you in is where the tension is, where you're not getting what's expected, the expectation, you know. So a good composer, a good player will kind of drag out that expectation. You don't get the land kind of until the end or just after the end.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, you know. And it's a fascinating...
Normally I would keep all that kind of theory at arm's length. And yet, when you say that, it makes perfect sense, actually.
Yeah, that's why that one makes particular sense to me. Now, the Retty, like, say, this would be going back to my college days, funnily enough, which is becoming very fresh to me in my period of reflection. The Retty is all about looking at the motifs and how they're inverted and all that kind of thing. That's not actually as interesting to me. It's kind of interesting, you know, to see, like, if it's a... I remember doing a Brahms Opus 79 was the piece, remember? And, you know, you're just looking at how the phrase is inverted and turned upside down and twisted all over the whole piece. And it all comes down to this couple of phrases, you know, which I'm not so sure how valuable that is. It's more interesting for me as a composer to see what's the expectation that's set up. But you don't think of that when you're writing.
Of course not.
It's flipping the last thing in your mind.
And Cathal's not thinking about that.
Absolutely not. I've always loved his playing and whoever he plays with. He's got particular magic. Of course, there's others. I always feel bad leaving out other ones that I love as well.
Well, we have a lot of them.
We have a lot of them. Yeah. I mean, you know, so many.
Let's not even start the list.
You know, I was going to say a few names, but I'm not going to.
Well, so
leave it to Cathal.
Go back to your first exposure to music, Julie. You say that, you know, your mother took you to a lot of lessons, and so you did all that stuff that a lot of kids do, and are often kind of, they often do it against their will. Really, they're not all that keen. Were you up for it?
Oh, I was completely up for it, and I was the one colluding with my mother to get other siblings. I was that annoying sister, you know, to try and get the other ones to go to whatever it was. But I just loved it with a passion. I mean, I was like at 3 and 4, I was kind of organising people into groups. I was always kind of directing little groups. And I was in school, I was always...
3 and 4?
Yeah, I mean, I was always trying to get people to sing in together and sing. I don't know if I was doing harmony, but I was always kind of putting them, kind of directing, like being a little musical director kind of thing. And I just, I wasn't as much, I was quite shy as a child. I wasn't desperate to perform. I knew I wanted to, but I think it was that kind of like, no, don't stick your head above the pulpit sort of attitude that meant that I wasn't like a jumping out like a Billy Barry kid kind of wanting to be.
So it wasn't showbiz.
A Billy Barry kid, that type of performance. You know, when I say like a Billy Barry kid, that's no, I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean I was never that kind of child.
Yeah.
But I think I really discovered myself as a performer after my second album, when I kind of went, hang on a minute, there's a whole load of places in here.
Well, let's leave all that to later, because that, you know, when you did appear in the scene, it was really interesting because of where you'd come from and all the rest of it. But when you started lessons first, was it piano lessons or...?
Piano was the very first one that I started, yeah.
What did you make of that experience, from being the bossy one in the schoolyard to somebody rapping your knuckles with a ruler? Well, I'm sure that didn't happen, but being told what to do.
Very early on I started playing by ear, which wasn't great for the sight reading in that side of things. But I went with my older brother, who's brilliantly musical. The piano teacher actually said he was more musical than I, which is very possible. So it was just something we did, but we did love it. And Mrs. Buchan on Loyola Park, across from Loch Atholia, I remember, you know, this lovely, lovely house, little porch and all that kind of thing. And I remember the smell of it. And I remember her mother. as well. So it was a lovely experience, you know.
Good.
But I was very shy. I was actually very shy.
And what was driving you to learn, though? Was it just sheer pleasure?
Sheer pleasure. I wasn't even thinking of what it was. I was making up tunes. I was absorbing tunes. I was in it. Mm. I didn't even have to be suggested to me, you know. I played the piano every single day of my childhood without fail. I would sit for hours and play the piano. You know, there was no question I was going to do anything else.
Wow.
I was always into people. I knew I was going to do something with psychology or something like that, which I did do. But there was pure joy. It was a place I could go, you know. And I wasn't as much into the singing. Well, I did sing, but piano was my whole thing. But I'm not actually that. I'm not really that good a piano player at all. They all used to think I was in my house, but I'm actually not that great.
And what about at school? Because then, again, when you go into school and you have to fall into line with whatever the teacher's projects are and so on, you end up doing things you're not particularly interested in, or you end up in a musical or a little band or something. It may not be your thing, but you kind of have to go along with it. How did you find that experience?
I wasn't really like that. I was one of these that just loved everything.
Yeah.
I loved all the subjects. I loved Irish, I loved history, I loved geography, I loved everything. I was kind of really, I sound like I was really annoying. I don't know if I was actually that annoying. I don't think I was showy offy, but I definitely loved every subject. And I remember thinking, the weird thing to think was I kind of wished that I didn't have abilities in other subjects, because it would make it easier to pick what I wanted to be. Wow. So it was still a problem for me, because I ran around frantically in my 20s doing a million degrees because, you know, still like, oh, sugar, I wish I wasn't able to do that.
So you were kind of an all-rounder, really, at school.
Yeah, I was an all-rounder, yeah. And, I just was. And then my mother was the school principal. So I had that thing, I had to learn discretion very early on, where you'd be out in the, you know, there might be somebody saying something about your mother in the playground, but you had to weirdly kind of absorb it and not get upset.
A difficult dynamic, that one.
It was a difficult dynamic, but we learned, you know, I had to learn very early on about that.
Julie, next musical choice.
Another favourite of mine, Máirtín O'Connor. I can't even explain, like with Cathal, what happens, you know, to my body when he's playing. You know, it's absolutely sublime. I've actually worked with Máirtín since. He's such a beautiful person. You couldn't imagine someone to be such a beautiful person and be such a pretty much a genius on his instrument, you know.
Máirtín O'Connor, Perpetual Motion, the second choice of Julie Feeney, is with me in studio tonight. I mean, Máirtín O'Connor is one of the great traditional musicians, but you can tell listening to that he has clearly got an awful lot more going on musically. That's as baroque as it gets, doesn't it?
Oh, stop. He's so much going on. That album, Perpetual Motion, there was a particular time, I don't know, maybe it was like 5 months, I just listened to it nonstop. My mother actually loved it as well, which I remember at the time thinking, that's kind of unusual that she liked the album, you know, because it's... I hope he doesn't mind me saying it's not kind of straight trad or, you know, I just love it. And I do have a big kind of influence in that. I mean, I love Bach. And I loved fugues and preludes, when I playing fugues and preludes. That's what I love, the intricacy of it, the melodies, all of that. Just
it's funny how often Bach will come up, you know. I have spoken to, well, obviously a lot of jazz musicians love Bach. But I've met hip hop people as well who love Bach. You know, everybody, you know, as you say, everybody loves Bach. Anybody who's heard Bach tends to go for that. In fact, if you have any classical music at all, just get some Bach. You forget about the rest of it.
Yeah, but it's such a central kind of, it kind of encapsulates everything. You know, you could access it from many points.
Yeah. Well, it swings, and it sounds improvised a lot of the time, and sometimes it is.
Yeah,
but it really swings, and it's got a real feel to it.
Yeah, it can be interpreted in so many ways.
So, when did you start taking music sort of seriously from the point of view of, because you did go down the academic route.
Yeah.
So when you were doing, say, you're leaving and you're at that sort of stage of your life, what were you thinking about? Because as you alluded to earlier, there were a lot of things you could have done. And in fact, you did a lot of things. So tell me a little bit about your academic route.
A load of things. I mean, psychoanalysis, that is a big interest. I did that master's. I did like three master's. But I know, it's crazy. I think it's that kind of, again, hamster wheel thing, running round and round, frantically running round.
Yeah, but no, you see, there's a difference, Julie. There are people who do things where they do a bit of this and a bit of that and a bit of the other, and they end up not really doing anything. But you know, three masters is not being, what's the word, a flibbertigibbet.
It's not, but what's the purpose of all of that? I don't think that it is like an insecurity. So with some people, I think it's like an insecurity that they want to. For me, I'm sure there are psychoanalysts listening to this going, I'm afraid, honey, you know. But I wanted to feel that I'd explored certain aspects to a certain level. Now, I did, as a psychoanalyst, it was talk of doing a doctorate. But I remember saying, no, I'm not going to do that. I feel like I'm too young. I want to live. And I'm really glad that I didn't. And I'll do one eventually.
Where was this, by the way?
It was Trinity.
Trinity, yeah.
But I'm now putting it into my writing because I'm going into, which we'll come back to, but long form is now what I'm interested in terms of words, narrative.
Oh.
I'm obsessed with stories.
And will remind me to talk about that.
Yeah.
But again, with the studies again, I mean, it's, there are lots of people who bounce around from one degree to the next and they don't finish any of them. And it's because they're unsettled and they're unsure of what they're doing and they've been given the wrong advice and all these things. But what you did involved enormous commitment to do one master's after another.
Yeah, but not really when you're on the hamster wheel because you're just like, you know, the school, college, blah, blah, blah thing. I did teaching as well. I mean, I think music, people, big rooms of people. Mm. That sort of sums it all up. Me acting the maggot in the middle of it in a musical
theme. But you were obsessed with music from the age of three.
Mm-hmm.
So why did you devote so much time to psychoanalysis when you could have done music?
I needed to get it out of my system.
So what was the attraction?
I don't think
it
was proven either to anybody. What?
What was the attraction of psychoanalysis?
It's absolutely fascinating. The Freudian stuff is just.
Yeah, but you don't know that when you're nine. Maybe you did.
When you're nine?
Yeah.
No, I know. No, but I knew I was interested in how people think and how people interacted with one another. I had a lot of good case studies around me that I remember being fascinated.
So it was your actual lived experience then? That led
it was my lived experience at the time, yeah. But I don't think that. I found an essay that I wrote when I was eight and there was psychology was in it. Being a pop star was in it. Being a missionary was in it.
Really?
Traveling the world, yeah. Do you know, that was all the kind of the era of everybody going to the missions.
Had you thought about the convent at any point? No.
Definitely interested in theology.
Mm.
And I think, I mean, if women were, here we go, headlines. No, I would be interested, I studied theology, but I did argue a lot with the teacher at the time. This was in Pat's. Feminist theology is fascinating. I would possibly be interested if women could be priests. You know what I mean? It might have been something I thought of. I do find it fascinating. I really do find theology very interesting.
Oh, but there's a difference in theology and belief, isn't there? Do you know? Loads of people could have great conversations about theology, but then when it comes to, but do you believe any of this stuff, then they back off.
Well, I mean, cultural Catholicism, you know, when you don't really think about that. That's it's been ingrained in you. The smell of the candles, the sound of the peace in a church. Mm. There's no question, you know, there's like a certain peace in certain places. The font, the sound, the water spilling, that kind of thing, the smell of the incense, all that kind of thing. So that's a whole different thing, I think, than to spirituality and connection.
So you're telling me now that after, you know, masters in, well, I couldn't even list the things you've done degrees in, but that if you had the opportunity now, you'd take holy orders. You'd become a priest.
Would I become a priest?
Because I'm there.
Huh?
I'm right there. If you become a priest, I'll be in the front row.
You have to have a little bit of an ego to be a priest, I'd say. You know, like, I definitely have an ego, very big ego. So
can't say I ever met a priest with an ego.
Well, you know... I think if you're like, so I think if you're a good teacher, you're a good rouser of people. Mm. So if you're a bit of a performer, if you think of like a good priest that's good at giving a sermon, they have all of those skills, you know, they're able to do all of these things, and those, they're not too far removed from what I'm doing. But I think I can definitely tell you, there's no room in my life for me to go off to become a priest right now. I've sort of got a lot of other things.
It's a shame, because we've, you know, all sorts of things have come up on these programs, but that would have been a first. If it happens, let me know. We'll do a live outside broadcast.
I'll run a bus.
So, what are we talking about? Yes, all these degrees that you did. Now, you ended up, if I remember correctly, Judy, when I met you first, which is a long time ago now, you were doing, or had just finished, very interesting music degree at Trinity, which involved technology.
Yeah.
So it was, what was that? Was called that, wasn't it? Music and technology.
Music and media technologies. Yeah. So there was everything in it, from DSP.
That's easy.
Digital
for you
signal
say.
Processing, okay. Which I didn't particularly love, you know, but I did do it. I mean, it was like doing, for me, it was like doing honours maths. Even I remember doing that, you know, and not really my cup of tea. But it was everything from that, sound design, programming, algorithmic composition. Now, I did bury myself. I buried myself completely, exclusively in that time in electroacoustic music, electronic music. That's all I did for the whole 2 years. I had my Akai sampler, my zip discs, and even floppies at the start of it. And I absolutely adored the Akai sampler. I mean, like the Sound Forge and all of that, I was just very into that.
And what were you listening to around that time then?
I was very much listening to, I mean, I had previously in Cork when I studied music and psychology there.
You see, you just keep saying these things. Music and psychology in Cork.
But that's like,
that's separate to three masters.
Yeah, it is separate, but
in psychoanalysis.
Yeah, but I mean, but psycho. So,
and now we're talking a degree in music.
Okay,
and
if you think of psychoacoustics, though, I mean, that's really fascinating.
Psychoacoustics.
Well, that's what I. Yeah, that's what I did in Holland.
So the
marriage of physiology, psychology of sound, and the perception of sound, essentially, those three things. Like, that's just fascinating. Surely for you.
Psychoacoustics.
Yeah.
Psychoacoustics.
Psychoacoustics.
Right, that's
amazing.
That.
But it is. I mean, you think about it. For any music,
I don't know what it is, but it's blowing my mind.
Yeah, but it's, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, how music can bring emotions up in you, how you perceive it and the actual.
But it's interesting you want to analyse that, though, because we all know music brings up emotion, you know, and sometimes you don't need to press any further with that.
Well, the interesting thing is, the more you dig deeper in yourself, for example, you find these incredible kind of buttons, and you're like, oh my goodness, so this is what that button is. Mm-hmm. That's what I do. Oh, now all I need to do is just not switch that one on, you know. So it's all analysis, like you're analysing yourself all the time. So
let's play some music from that period when you were listening to this kind of music.
There's so
stuff
all that
down
time,
your list here, which
Zanakis, Varese, Schaefer, Boulez, Stockhausen, but like all of that music, I absolutely adore, like Varese.
Tell you what, let's have some Zanakis. Now, I listen to this kind of stuff once in a blue moon when I'm in a certain kind of a mood. It doesn't happen often because it's hard work in a way. I mean, it's not easy music, but I think it's worth it. But you want to play something by Zanakis. What do we play?
We're going to play Concrete PH.
Okay. Music there from Zanakis, Concrete PH, the choice of Julie Feeney, who's with me in studio tonight. The thing about that kind of music, Julie, and I don't know about you, but when you find that sort of music, first of all, I think for most people, they've never heard anything like it at all before. And it's a whole kind of whole world out there. And you mentioned, I think you said mentioned Varese, did you? And
Varese, I mean.
And all, and Stockhausen and stuff like that. I had to go and find out about this or to read up on it because I thought, there's all this music out there that nobody ever told me about.
Mm-hmm.
And what was it like for you suddenly being really deeply into it?
Well, it's the access point is sound design. You know, you're starting to actually make your own sounds and design your own sounds. Then you're recording sounds and you're messing about with the sound to make it sound different, then you're blending them, then you're creating a composition, and then you start to listen to people who do it expertly.
Yeah.
Some of the most famous composers that have ever lived. And I mean, it's music. It's another type of music. But you're working with sounds instead of actual acoustic instruments. I really loved it. I only incorporated a little bit subsequently. My first album, I had the sound of a train. I mean, it's not exactly incorporating a lot. Just recorded the Dublin Galway train from Athlone. It's not exactly very high tech, but it's all around us. I mean, you can have a little 2-year-old who might sit there and go, listen, listen. And you look up and the leaves are rustling. Mm. Or what's that? What's that sound? And it's the sound of a lorry in the rain with a bit of the mudguard scraping against the tire or something.
Yeah.
Sounds. It's just like found sounds. When you start to work with those, when your ears become attuned to that, say as a composer, sure, it's a whole world. I mean, you can make absolutely anything out of anything. So it's not that different to normal music. And I know it's not that different to acoustic music or music that's more regularly heard. I know that you can have, it can be quite challenging, but that's down to the composition, or else you have to surrender to the composition and just let yourself go into whatever zone it is.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying I'm not in that world now. I came out of that. That kind of sonically, I just became interested in different things. I like the sound of a real cello with the sound of the actual bow against the bridge or whatever it is. It's all like a journey. I think it's kind of like you're going around in this little car around life. You're doing, okay, bit of psychology here. You're going to learn about the inside of people's heads. Then over, what does that sound like? Okay, move over here now. These are the found sounds, moving on to all that world. It's like you're just hoovering up experiences, hoovering up the world around you.
And will you tempted or were you in danger of staying within academia then, because you were getting so, you were there for obviously quite a long time?
I wouldn't be able to stay in academia.
No, it's not for everybody, obviously.
Yeah, but I mean, there's an awful lot of academics who are publishing regularly, they're composing regularly, and that works brilliantly. Mm. Some of our best artists, composers or academics do that. Just for me, I mean, I did teach in a primary school for a year.
But what stopped you? When did you finally think, right, that's enough, degrees, don't need any more degrees?
When I realised, I'm not going to tell you what year it was, but I was in bed asleep and I realised what age I was going to be on my next birthday, and I sat up straight.
All right.
And I went, hang on a minute, what about this music you're supposed to be composing? Along the way, I mean, I started composing music for contemporary dance. So I used a lot of that world, like the sounds, whether it was electronic or electroacoustic or whatever combination it was, then moving into, okay, the time is now. You need to actually put your money where your mouth is. Not your money, but you need to make this, make this music that you keep talking about and you keep telling everybody about. So there's a lot of procrastination in there as well. It sounds very glorious, kind of going around, oh yes, I think I'll study this now. Oh, I'll do another master's. You're actually, there is a little bit of, not really in doing the master's, but in doing the other stuff, you have to just face the music. It's a better way to say it. And I worked as a choral singer, actually. I forgot about that.
You worked as a choral singer?
Yeah.
Were you,
professionally, yeah.
Am I right? Were you ever in a Nuna?
I was, yeah. I was in a Nuna. Toured with the Nuna, recorded a little bit.
Were you ever in Riverdance?
I was in Riverdance.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I was in Lord of the Dance.
I'm just curious from the point of view of a singer who's got a lot to contribute. You know, it must have got kind of difficult, I'd imagine. Thankless task.
I'm curious about the world.
Mm.
I've always been curious and I like to explore. When it came to choral music, I absolutely loved sitting in the middle of, if it was a Nuna, which is particularly, people don't read music, so they're very at one with what they're hearing and the sounds around them. It was an incredible experience to be in the middle of that. When I was in National Chamber Choir, which is now Chamber Choir Ireland, you're in the middle of a 17 piece quarter tone singing on a Tuesday morning. You have to pick your note out of wherever it is. I certainly wouldn't be turning my nose up at that either.
Yeah.
When I was in Christchurch Cathedral Choir, you had to, the turnover of, over of music, you have to do new music every single service.
Well, I can see how exciting that is, but I'd say if you're doing Lord of the Dance every night of the week.
I did. No, well, Lord of the Dance, I sang solo in front of 6,000 people, 15 minutes on my own on the stage. That kind of a performance experience you can't get anywhere else unless you're in a big stadium touring in France. You know, so I did it for about 3 months. Riverdance, the same. It's the performance experience and, of course, the beautiful music. Well, the Riverdance music is absolutely gorgeous. So I did that for 4 months. So I think it made me more rounded performer.
Bill Whelan, God bless him, has always been quite close to you in your career, hasn't he?
Bill is definitely probably my professional mentor. He's probably wondering where I am at the moment. But I'll be seeing him soon. He knows, you know, but he knows that I've been very busy. But he's been a huge, advocate and like a professional mentor. I mean, I've had earlier ones, like in college, say Micheál or Mel, definitely. But I think at a certain stage, Bill, you know, I got a scholarship from Bill in Trinity. Mm. So definitely very useful. And when I actually applied for Riverdance, I didn't tell him. And he just said, well, I'm glad that you didn't tell me, you know, because it would have been a bit... Yeah. Hey, I want to get into Riverdance. So I got in, just I did the audition normally and that. But that's an amazing experience. I was very aware at the time when these things were blowing up, these shows. I was kind of, the time is now for any singer or performer to get as much experience as possible in these. So I did 4 month stints in both.
And great experience just as a professional performer.
Oh my goodness. You know. So when are you going to get that? When are you going to be that close to something that's as big as Cats or, you know? We haven't had that, you know, before, so...
Julie, next choice. You've got such a list here, we could go anywhere. Well, let's have some choral music, seeing that's what we were talking about. And you have various people on the list here. Periton is one you used to talk to me about, I remember. You introduced me to his music. In fact, you bought me the CD after a gig one night.
Did I?
Yeah, you did, yeah. And I think it was after Arvo Pärt in the concert hall or something. And, we're going to have what? The Palestrina?
Okay, yep.
Okay. Music there from Palestrina, and that was Secret Service, Harry Christopher in the 16, the choice of Julie Feeney. Of course, that Harry Christopher's thing, you know, that was popular as well, or is popular. I mean, it's not like, but you know, getting into this type of music that you were taking yourself into some obscure territory. I mean, this is you know, he sells records.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely. Well, the great thing about, I mean, I spent, I think, probably full time, 6 years sort of full time, and then along with academia and other things, being a choral singer, the repertoire, I was lucky that I covered the pop choral ones, you know, as in that.
Yeah.
And then the very obscure kind of pieces, contemporary classical.
It must be wonderful to sing that, though, to be in with a bunch of people singing that.
There's nothing like, I mean, it's absolutely an incredible experience. And to be just doing that as your job, it was just pure bliss. And we were really, I absolutely loved my time in all of the ensembles. I remember that we had Celso Antunes, Brazilian conductor. That was just a wonderful time in the National Chamber Choir. Some of the music we performed, the tours we did.
I love when choirs sing that really, the really complex stuff.
Yeah.
And you think it must be a lot of fun if you could sing, and I can't, but to be able to sing in the middle of all that.
To be in the middle of it and with singers who can sing it, who can actually sing it and can sing it in tune and sing it perfectly, it's an amazing experience. It's amazing for your ears and for your mind to experience that. You know, I feel very lucky that I had that experience going forward. Yeah.
What's singing all about, Julie? What do you think? I mean, I know birds do it, but the birds do it for territorial reasons and to attract a mate.
Well, it's a very complex thing, I think, singing, because when I'm in, and I've had a really, really difficult time or something, but everything has conspired against me, or no, I don't, that sounds, things are not conspiring against you, it's just the way that they happen. Mm. I know that whenever, when I was on tour in the States, Cormac DeBarra, he used to always love when I'd had, like, when I was in bad, not bad mood, but things had been difficult, because I would sing so much better, because the emotional, the depth of emotion was so much richer because of that. And I know that if I've had a nightmare of a day and I do a show, something happens, the singing just always comes out, you know. The only time when it doesn't is when your mind is not, when you're lack, when you don't have focus. That happened to me once last year. I did a performance and I wasn't focused, and I was really glad that it wasn't recorded. But
you're probably the only one who knew that.
No. I just know it. But singing, what is it about? It's just, I mean, it's an expression. It's definitely an expression. It's not like in composition. I mean, I think your job as an artist is not just to express. It is to create a world around the expression so that other people can access that piece of that emotion or those feelings. I don't think you're just... just expressing. Sometimes in singing it feels like you are, but so I sound like I'm contradicting myself, but I think the best performance is you have this emotion and feeling, and with the way you're going to execute it, you have a world around it, so it's presentable to others, so they can come in as well, they're allowed in. It's the difference between that and something that's really indulgent, when you kind of go, oh my goodness, this is just way too intense, I don't want to be here. Or it might even be what you were referring to in some of the electroacoustic world, electronic music. You just don't feel that you're a part of it. But I think if there's an access point, and like the skill and the talent and the for people who are geniuses is to have that, to have the ability to make that access point.
But I think singing in particular has a huge effect on a listener. Whether it's one person, but in particular, if it's a bunch of people singing. I mean, if you hear I went into a Russian Orthodox church once in what was then the Soviet Union, and there was a male voice choir singing.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, you're reduced to, a heap listening to this stuff. It was the effect of it on you was, like, physical as well as everything else, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you're looking for, you know, particularly if you've had a difficult time or if you're feeling things that are difficult, you want to express them somehow, but you can't actually express them in your life for various reasons. And then when you hear something like that, there's some kind of resonance. You're like, oh, yes, that's I can. And that's why it's so enriching, because it's like it's exactly answering that spot. That's that button or where the plaster has been taken off.
Now, your next choice, just before we take a break, we haven't actually played what you might call straight ahead classical yet. And Beethoven's on the list.
Beethoven's on the list, but late Beethoven. Beethoven is the one composer that is above and beyond. I know I love Bach and loads of others, Messiaen, and there's so many more. I mean, Schoenberg, Gershwin, Stravinsky, I haven't even talked about him. But Beethoven, most definitely, if you're talking about going into the church in when you were away, you mentioned there, late Beethoven in particular, those late string quartets, they are absolutely, for me, the most superior expression of emotion. It is just so contemporary. It's so complex. Those quartets, the Opus 131 or all those. I can listen to them. There was one morning I was driving around and there was something going on, and I just put that on, and he just transported me. There's no question about it. It's like as if he can read your mind, the depths of passion in it.
Now, you have analysed music, right? I'm curious about this. You've analysed music and you know how it works.
Yeah.
How much of what someone like Beethoven does is as a result of him knowing all that, or, to use that word, it's just genius?
I mean, yeah, we use the word just genius, but I think he was definitely troubled and found a vehicle to express it. His mind was so fascinating and complex that he had the ability to express, particularly the use of the strings and the writing. I don't know. I don't think he's on the outside. He's right on the inside. He's actually expressing there, but he has the key. He knows what about the human psyche. It's like as if he knows more than anybody else. That's just innate in him. Like every time I did analyze those, and I remember writing one stage big long essay, particularly these quartets. And at the end of it, I just listened, sat back again, and it was like as if I'd listened to it for the first time. All the words, all the analysis were completely redundant. Yeah. It's absolutely like, it just touches my soul. There's no, he's right there, right bang, right in the middle of my soul.
So this is the first movement of the string quartet in C sharp minor, and it's the Alban Berg Quartet, music from Beethoven. Music there from Beethoven, the opening movement of the string quartet. Opus 131, Julie, isn't it? I don't know what number that is. It's the one in C sharp minor, and that's the Alban Berg string quartet performing it there. Music from Beethoven. Julie Feeney with me in studio tonight. Julie, we're going to take a quick break, actually, and when we come back, we'll talk about Julie Feeney, the pop star. And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM, the Sunday night special where we get someone to pick the tunes. Tonight it's Julie Feeney. And the first hour of the programme tonight, Julie talked about, you know, how she got into music and the different routes that she went down and the different types of music she was exposed to. But I think for the next part of the programme, Julie, let's talk about when you first appeared in your own right as Julie Feeney, pop music. More to it than it was art pop, whatever it was. Did you have a name for it, actually?
Not really.
No. Well, because nobody...
You once said chamber pop.
Well, did I say that?
I think so, because then I thought, oh, that kind of sounds good. And then other people are going, no, don't use that.
Chamber pot.
Chamber pot, like... I mean, whatever it is, I don't know, it's...
Yeah, well, you see, I remember at the time a lot of people weren't sure, because you know what the music business is like, they want to put you in a box straight away so they can talk about you. But it was odd, it was from somewhere else. You were coming from somewhere else. You could tell that you'd come from a background that was classical and all the rest of it, and you were writing these great pop songs. So what was it that happened then, Julie, that, you know, you finally... This is the way you started to express what you'd been working up to for a long time?
So I think being a perfectionist, as anyone, as all perfectionists know, is a bad thing, because you can procrastinate. And for me, I knew that I wanted to, I was always since I was small, wanted to be a composer and writer. But it just began to realise the time's up. You have to do it now, you know. I didn't know where I was going with it. But I knew that it had to be made, had to be done. Looking back again, traditional tunes, and particularly lilting and all of that, had been there in the background somewhere. And I actually ended up doing one of the tunes on 13 songs is actually lilting. Mm. And that comes from Irish music, but I wasn't aware of it at the time, or people didn't kind of hone in on that as much at the time.
But you see, it wasn't just that. It was also sort of Meredith Monk and that sort of music that's sort of, you know, she's extremely well known, but a lot of people will never have heard of Meredith Monk or that type of music.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of people won't have heard that. There's so much to absorb when you're trying to do your own thing. There's all that music industry stuff that just changes every year anyway. So there's no point in... I mean, I remember doing all these courses on sort of music business or whatever, and now I would just be like, don't do any of it, don't even read anything about any of that, because it's going to change anyway in 2 years.
Well, did you have a musical model? Was there another artist out there that you thought, that's the kind of thing I want to do?
No, there wasn't. And I didn't have anybody like, say, now I have somebody, so for visual stuff or for Now, for like long for stories, which I'll get to, like I have somebody, Marina Carr, I can ask. But for music, I didn't. No, I didn't. Anyone that was so like later on, say Bill Whelan, definitely is a mentor, but more. Not as much in the music. I mean, he definitely has said things to me about it, but more
well,
in terms Jake, of
well, so, I mean, Bill worked a bit with Kate Bush, for instance, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm not just picking these people because they're women. I'm not picking the easy examples. But when I think of Kate Bush or I think of Bjork or I think of artists like that, I think those are people that you might have seen as inspirational in their attitude to music, you know, their approach to it.
Bjork was massive for me. Suzanne Vega was massive for me. Tori Amos, massive for me as well. Mm. You know, Boys for Pele, all of Suzanne Vega's stuff. I wasn't as much aware at the time of people like Meredith Monk and that, even though subsequently I did, and I've met her and all that kind of thing, and she's fantastic. When I studied in Holland, I remember there would be all these brilliant students going up, giving these unbelievable talks about symphonies and whatnot, and they knew every single note and every single motif, and I did not know that. And I remember then I would give a talk and it would be, well, there'd be a bit of laughing and, you know, a bit of fun, and because I just presented it in whatever way, but they knew way more than me about actual music. So I remember thinking at the time of feeling lucky that coming from Ireland, you're not kind of pigeonholed into anything. So I never felt pigeonholed into anything, or I didn't feel like I wanted to imitate anybody or anything like that. But I know for a fact the three that I did love in terms of female, Bob Dylan, huge. I mean, I just worship Bob Dylan.
Well, we maybe get to Bob in a minute, but let's play one of these women you're talking about. Which one do you want? I mean, we can get any of these for you. So what do you fancy?
Bjork. What an artist.
Music there from Bjork, Like Someone in Love, the choice of Julie Feeney, who's with me in studio tonight. Julie, I'm curious though that, you know, when you started out as Julie Feeney and came on the scene and there was a huge amount of interest in you, and as I said earlier, a lot of people couldn't figure out what it was you were doing. You know, what is this? What's it like? You know, that's the way the music business works. But where did that sort of aesthetic come from, do you think? How much time did you spend on that? It's not going to be heavy guitars. It's not going to be this. I'm going to use a recorder. You know, all the odd things that you did. I mean, not odd to you, but that sounded odd to people in the normal sort of pop world.
Yeah, it's a peculiar thing. Funnily enough, the root of my mentioning the trad thing again, I'm actually rhythms and the rhythm of a phrase and rhythms within things. I should have come out with like a drumming album first of all, because I'm actually so motivated by rhythms within things. But I just hate overstating something or something, making something really obvious. There's something about my melodies and songs that could be made very naff, very easily, very quickly.
Or let me put it another way. It could be massive, massive hits if they were done a different way.
Well, that is funny.
I don't mean you should, but Love is a Tricky Thing and Impossibly Beautiful and all those songs with one of those producer type guys who does these things, you'd hate it. I'd hate it, but it'd be a massive hit.
Yeah, I'm tempted.
Yeah, I know. Well, it is. You know, you have to make choices, don't you?
And
you
yeah, did. I know. There was somebody did remix Million and One Things, I think it was, from my first album, and it sounded straight on the radio, you know, and I just hated it. But yeah, maybe I should just try it out as an experiment, since I've been experimenting all along.
No, but you had very clear, aesthetic all the time, but you had this very clear sense of what way you wanted to do things.
Yeah, I know. And I'm trying to, I think I grew away from that a little bit in terms of performance. When I remember I performed first with the Ulster Orchestra, I orchestrated 13 songs. The guy called Declan McGovern, I think, invited me to do that, which was a massive opportunity, and I was so grateful to him that he did, because it actually meant that I subsequently did a whole lot of other projects and got much handier with the orchestra. But I remember being on stage and like listening to the second clarinet and the second viola and all this, you know, which is completely the wrong thing to be doing. And performance was fine, grand, person on stage, opening mouth, singing songs, but absolutely nowhere near what I think now about a performance. I think I've become not divorced from the aesthetic. I still have the aesthetic, but I'm actually much more centered on what your job is supposed to be. Like if you are on stage, you need to be 1,000% committed to that. It doesn't matter if, literally, if the lights fall down, one of my biggest fears, but literally, you need to be completely in the zone. So I think I did abandon a bit of that aesthetic in my choice of instruments to present my songs live. So I would have been very particular at the very start. I remember I did a Beauty's Cafe Theatre and I had backing tracks and everything on the stage. Went, because I wanted to replicate the album, went from that to touring around America, like a 20-day tour with a harp, you know. So I was able to abandon all that kind of aesthetic. And then I went as far as actually doing the whole show with tracks, which kind of makes me kind of go, because it was a theatre show. But at least I felt it was a growth. I was trusting myself, trusting the actual melodies that they could be delivered on stage.
Some musicians, Julie, and some successful musicians will tell you that what works for them best are their limitations. They can only do certain things. They only know a certain amount of chords and they can only do it in a certain way and it works for them. You know, the thing with you is, you know, you could arrange for the orchestra, you could conduct the orchestra, you could do everything, which is not necessarily as good as it sounds.
But it's the same thing. That's what I was thinking when I was like a teenager. I was thinking that it would be better if I wasn't good at all these other things. Mm. But it's the same thing now. But like if I'm an artist making decisions and being good at culling, I'm actually good on the culling, but let my imagination run wild and what something could be like, you know, I need to rein it in. Like it is it's my job. Like I should be better at it, you know.
You mentioned Suzanne Vega a moment ago. Do you want to hear?
Yeah.
I am sitting in the morning at the diner on the corner. I am waiting at the counter for the man to pour the coffee, and he fills it only halfway. And before I even argue. And I finish up my coffee and it's time to catch the train.
Tom's Diner there from Suzanne Vega, the choice of Julie Feeney, who's with me in studio. The other thing you did, Julie, when you appeared on the scene as well, you were putting a lot into performance in terms of, you know, things like maybe Björk might have been an influence again there, but what you were wearing and the production of the show and all the rest of it. You're thinking about all that as well.
Yeah. Well, I think that's like an escape route. I mean, my GP at home in Athenry, great man, Dr. Vivian Brennan, a huge music lover, he would always slag me about the house on the head. Yeah. You don't need to wear that. Will you take that thing off you?
This is a hat you had, which was literally a house.
Yeah.
Small house, has to be said. But
yeah,
still.
But it might be, like there's a funny thing in there, I'm trying to work it out at the moment, but I do have a fear of falling buildings. This is one of my anxieties and things falling on my head. And then
it's the second time you've said that. You mentioned the lights earlier. No, yeah. So this is real.
Yeah, no, yeah, it is real because I'm excited about, I'm kind of sick of this thing now, so I'm just going to actually challenge it and find out why do I have this and really dig in and find out what it is. But there must be something there, like wearing
You did wear a lot of mad hats. And also Strange Dream made a paper dress. Do you remember that?
Made out of the scores of the orchestra, the actual scores, yeah. I think that that's definitely valid because I think when you grow up, so it was a rural part of Ireland, loads of music in my family, but not... I didn't have any exposure because who would of people performing, you know, standing up in the middle of a room and getting into a song and everybody, you know, that whole experience, many people experience that, but I didn't particularly have that. Mine was more about was excellent exposure and development of my talents by my mother. But it wasn't kind of, I wasn't watching someone singing, you know, right beside me and going, wow, they're actually really in that. I hadn't seen that ever happen. So I think a lot of that costume stuff is a way so I could be a different person on stage. I do think it's nice to have a bit of a remove, because it's quite confronting being right up, like singing your heart out. I'm not quite sure where I'm going to go next in terms of how I'm going to perform. There's definitely going to be a difference. I do like visual things, and I do like things to look beautiful, and I do like a show at the same time. But I think, yeah, there was a bit of a little bit of hiding behind it. But also when you're on stage, I mean, I've dabbled in not really acting, but sort of working on the edges of contemporary dance and acting, like monologue kind of things.
Yeah.
And you go to places that you have never been before. Like, you literally go on stage. That's why I love it so much. You can actually, you feel like it's the senses. Your senses feel like you are physically and in every way in a brand new place that you've never been before. So you've discovered this place inside yourself. And I think wearing a lot of the costumes and that helped me go in there, you know. I think maybe it's possible that I might try now to come out of that and try and get into it without having as much of that. Who knows? I don't know. We'll see in about 6 or 8 months' time.
Well, it's also can be a challenge to the audience too, in a good way, because, you know, you were kind of putting it up to the audience in lots of ways, you know. As you said, there's an element of acting in what you were doing. I mean, I suppose there is with all singers up front, but you were, you know, as I say, costume changes.
Yeah, costume changes. Yeah, I mean, I do love getting into a character, and I would actually love to do a bit of acting. But the curious thing about this, I'm being very honest now, but since it's your show, like I did consider, it's all coming out. I've been thinking, what's that thing where people, you know, they've got a different stage name? I was kind of going, what would that be like?
Yeah,
I've started to think in that way now. I mean, I don't know if I'll do it. I just don't know. But I found it kind of curious that I started to think that way.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, why am I thinking that way? Why would I want to change my name and have a different stage name? But wouldn't it be really cool? Like, you just release this thing and be a different name. You could have like cartoon type videos. It would be, you know, I know your man in the UK and all that. Done a lot of that kind of thing.
Oh, Damon Albarn.
Yeah, Damon Albarn. But I don't even quite mean that, because there's a huge, you know, like the painter, sorry, what's his name, who does the murals?
Banksy.
Like, so that's great, but there's a lot of sort of ego or something. A lot of it is about who is the guy, who is that person who does it. I think I'm kind of interested in making a thing that's more about the thing than the person, something like that.
Speaking of which, Robert Zimmerman is on your list, who is better known under his stage name of Bob Dylan, although people have now forgotten that it's actually a stage name. It's been so successful for him.
Yes, I mean, yes.
And that's another thing about what you do.
I
didn't
even think of that.
Well, there's words with you. I mean, there's a lot of words as well. I mean, somebody who, you know, has this complicated musical background and produced this, whatever you want to call it, chamber pop, whatever it is, and the costumes and the performance and all the rest of it, you can nearly get away without having proper lyrics, but you do. I mean, so where did that side of it come from? The writing proper songs that mean things.
Well, going back to the whole psychology thing, I am now definitely into long form. So,
do you mean writing a novel?
I don't know what I'm writing. I'm writing something. I don't know what it is, but there's a whole thing. I don't know what it is. But getting back a little bit to your question first, words are music. They're absolutely crucial to me. I've always been, apart from on the first album, not as much, but the second and third album, my God, like every single syllable is really thought about. I'll spend like 12 weeks just on words with no music or no singing or no anything. So I've now gone, I think I could whack out, like if somebody kidnapped me and said, go in there now and make the next album, I could probably do it, right? Mm. Because as in I could make it. I don't know if it'd be any good, but I could do it. But I'm actually more interested in the long form thing. So I've been writing an awful lot. I've been trying to, as I read, a friend of mine gave me a book which is really brilliant, Not the Artist's Way, The Right to Write. I can't think of her name, the writer. But she talks about being knee-deep in the flow of life while being knee-deep in the flow of words. So, I mean, before I would have gone up to Anna McCarrick, the artist retreat, lock myself away. I wouldn't even meet the other artists. I wouldn't even eat dinner in the house because I'd be so in my own world, my own little bubble. But now I'm actually trying to kind of challenge myself as an artist to try and be, to let the real flow of life actually infuse your writing. And what it has made me be is just long form. So I was working on Bird, put it aside for the family matters, but now I'm kind of back again, kneading away at that on the long form in terms of the narrative. But also there's all this other narrative stuff, like I've got all this stuff written now and I don't know what's going to happen with it. I know that I'll pluck out 10 or 11 bits for the album. I know I can do that, but there's a whole other thing. I don't know where I'm going with it. I'm finding myself.
Sounds obsessed. Like you're on a roll.
Well, I don't know. I'm obsessed with. I mean, I'm watching TV dramas, and I'm finding myself timing them. Then I'm looking at librettos, and I'm going, "How long is that?" And then I'm looking at book. I don't know what it is, but I'm definitely writing an awful lot of, and it's longer form. But it'll have to wait until, you know, other things come out first. But you know all about that,
Bob Dylan. Just like Tom Thumb's Blues, that's Bob Dylan, the choice of Julie Feeney, who's with me in studio tonight. Julie, you said something earlier on at the top of the show, and I wanted to come back to it, that you feel you've got something to say now, and you were wondering what you were doing back then. Is that, what do you mean by that?
I think my sensitivity, it's funny. This is not like a kind of against artists or anything, but I found myself in situations a few times recently where I was with artists who were, you know, working and doing loads of stuff. But I found that I couldn't connect with them in the same way that I was able to before, because I felt that there's some sort of an emptiness or something. You know, I just feel that I want to go deeper in a conversation, or, you know, and that sounds. That's nothing to do with these people. They're perfectly brilliant people and brilliant artists and all that. But there's just a depth and a richness that in the actual living of my daily life that would make me not even be... I wouldn't go crazy if I saw a famous person, like a famous artist now. Mm. I'd be actually really interested in, like, people on the street and their stories and what... You know, I don't want to become a broadcaster.
Julie, this is because, like the rest of us, you might be getting older.
I think so. Well, it's a lot of it is to do with circumstances in life. There's a lot of pretty profound things have happened, which has made me more in touch, very much in touch with reality. Like, lots of personal things would have happened, and I think I'm just. Naturally, I've heard a lot of people say this about news. You know, they see the news. I find it much harder to see bad news now, that kind of thing. I think it feels like the shape of my brain has changed. I think, I don't even know if that's possible. But I think it's been kind of in servitude, kind of. Like if I'm asleep, I began to get like lower back, sort of a small bit, but it would go in an hour after I get up. But because I'm, my gait, even at nighttime, kind of like I'm ready to pounce, I'm ready to serve other people that need, you know, I'm caring for somebody as well. But so I think that kind of perspective on life, I learned how to drive, and I see how much impatience there is on the road and how people are so phenomenally, you know, say rude, or they have to get here, they have to get there. And I kind of can't understand how they can think like that. I was that person like 6 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago. So there's that sort of stuff. So what do I want to say? I have an awful lot of, like, it's definitely, the expression is not heavy and sad and all that kind of thing. It's
But there was nothing light or shallow about what you were doing on your albums. And you're not, true. Some people are like that. They want to throw away the stuff they did first. They're not happy with it. And you're a perfectionist, I know, and maybe you do feel a bit like that. And I don't understand, you know, maybe you could do something better now. You're always thinking you could do better. But at the same time, what you say as a young person, younger person, is also valid.
Yeah.
That's who you were.
It's valid. It is valid, but it just seems it's not as profound or something. Yeah, I think it's not. I mean, it is valid. Maybe I think I'm just, maybe I think I'm a better wordsmith now than I was.
Mm.
Maybe I'm not, I don't know. Maybe the melodies that I'm thinking about are better now. I can't quite really even express this, but I definitely feel like a different person, you know, and I think, well, you know, like people who go through profound sort of like life changes, I don't waste time on stuff or dealing with people that you know, don't wreck my head anymore because I just move on, you know?
Yeah. And how does that tie up with what sort of ambition you might have? I mean, do you have any ambition beyond wanting to do the work, wanting to do what you do?
I still have the same ambition. I know for one thing, aside from talking about living through profound life experiences, I'm definitely an artist. I know that. I definitely have to express I want to shape emotions and shape feelings. I want to create a world around them for other people to access. I definitely want to do that. I feel like I'm on this earth to do it. I think all the studying, like the psychology or the music, all the different types of music, all of that is going towards me making a thing that other people can access and come into. That's definitely my job, which is a relief because some people don't. Some people find that they aren't that anymore. They find that they don't want to express themselves in that way, or they don't have anything. They don't feel they don't want to express that. But I definitely do. I have so much more to express, but I have so much more to understand as well.
Mm.
I'm just digging deeper about just understanding the world.
But I mean, you had a proper approach, I always felt, to all of that, and you know, being a pop star or fame or anything like that. You had a good attitude to that because, I mean, I remember at the time there were people coming to you and, you know, dangling, you know, I guess money, but certainly attractive prospects, record labels and all that kind of stuff. And you said no.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Most people don't say no.
Well, you see, I'm really good on boundaries with my work. Not as much on my personal boundaries. It's like, I'm not as, you know, I like the whole servitude thing. Like I could do with more boundaries in that area. But when it does come to work, it is a curious thing. I'm really, really clear about it. And I can say yes or no. I can just say no. I'm able to say no easier.
Mm.
I don't know why that is. I think it's, we have to get the
you dressed yourself. You put on your own shows.
Yep.
And there were people coming to you, I'm sure, you know, you've done modelling and all the rest of it, who wanted you to dress this way and dress that way and be photographed this way and be photographed that way. But you kept control of all of that in a way that hugely admirable, but possibly to your cost.
Possibly to my cost. But I think in the long run, though, it's to my benefit. Say, like, I remember when I was with Sony BMG, signed by the head of Sony in London, there was a photo shoot and it was that, what do you call that, chic, heroin chic kind of thing.
Mm.
And I was absolutely not, I did not want to be that at all. But there was a photo shoot and it just happened to be the person who was directing it, that's what they wanted to do. And I just said, I'm sorry, like, no, I. And they were probably lovely photographs, which I'll never get to see now anyway. But I've always had that certainty about things. Maybe it is to my detriment. Maybe I should just...
Not to your detriment. I mean just to your cost, if that's what you were after. But you weren't after that.
Yeah, but you see, the assumption could be sometimes if somebody is clear about what they want and there's people around, I know I can mould this. And then if I mould this, it will make it really successful. Yeah. But maybe I was just too loose a cannon in the first place.
Mm.
So maybe they just thought that this could be moulded, but actually just not. No. I could never have been that, like, when I see artists, I couldn't have been that. I'd have to be doing my own thing.
Your next choice, Against the Clock. Tell me about that.
When I was touring with Riverdance, one of the great things in my short stint was there was a band, so the musicians. So there were some amazing musicians, some of the top Irish musicians, and we got to meet other musicians on the road. So I was obsessed with the music of Vinnie Colaiuta, and all the music linked in with that, like Alan Holdsworth. And I remember going to some amazing concerts out in LA, like small little places, and you'd be right beside this world-class player. So that's a particular music that I wouldn't have probably gravitated towards. I may not have discovered it myself, but again, it's rooted in from the rhythms and the drums. I mean, I wish you could, I should have said Vinnie Colaiuta, somebody to play. But this particular song just has a lot of memories for me. It's beautiful. Alan Holdsworth, who actually passed away recently enough.
Against
the
clock.
Naomi Starr, I think, is the singer.
And that's called Against the Clock. Julie Feeney with me in studio tonight, picking the music. Vinnie Colaiuta.
Yeah. Amazing drummer.
Yeah, so there we go.
Incredible. Yeah, I met him actually.
Did you?
I actually tapped him on the shoulder and I just said, is that piece in, was it five or four? It was. I can't remember what the piece was. You could have, as a musician, you'd be thinking it's in four, but all the drummers were like, no, that's in five. And it's not that I'm thick or that I can't count. It's just the piece could actually, you could actually have pulsed it or conducted it in two different ways. But I was just like, I'm not the intuitive drummer, which is...
So what did he say to that question?
Oh, I was wrong and the drummers were right, you know. It was five.
Now, your next choice is a guy called Kevin Nolan.
Yeah.
And I've played a song of Kevin Nolan's on the radio a couple of times as well. Tell me about Kevin Nolan, because I've seen you've had him open for you in various things.
Yeah, he's just a fascinating, fascinating artist. I think he's got so much to say. The first time I heard this piece, I instantly was just hooked. I didn't even need to think about it. I was like, whatever that is, yeah, I definitely love this. He's an incredibly talented guy, such a smart person. He's really inspiring. I think he could go kind of any direction. He's just one of the most interesting that I've kind of come across. For a while now, I've just, he'll tell you, oh, I've written this and I've wrote poems, I've done art. I mean, he's just so multi-talented.
Remind you of anybody?
He's...
Kindred spirit.
Well, I think there's a bit of that or something, you know.
All right. But, and this song is called Splinter, and this is Kevin Nolan. Kevin Nolan there, a track called Splinter, the choice of Julie Feeney. So Julie, we've time for one more track. Before I do that, I said at the start I hadn't seen you in ages. When are we all going to see you again?
I'm really aiming to record in September.
Right.
And there's going to be a big blast of recording. A load of stuff is going to get recorded.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm entering a new phase.
And you think it's going to be different?
Well, it will, yeah.
Yeah. But it holds quite different by the sounds of things. Yeah.
What?
We'll still be friends. What are you planning?
You can't really be the same person. You can't do the same. You can't really feel the same thing twice. Don't know where. I always think that. That's why, you know, they keep saying, like feel it, get the feeling out and get all that, you know, because then when you do, you actually can't feel that again.
Yeah.
So, and I do get a little, not bored, and don't like the word bored, but yeah, and I think just flipping, throw a bit of caution to the wind, a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I heartily
you applaud
advise
this.
Throwing caution to the wind.
Yeah.
I think you should.
Yeah, I think, I feel like that, because I think there's a sort of resilience, like, you know, that's the big buzzword these days, resilience, but... I think to be more resilient and just kind of not have the crutches of certain things, and not being afraid to actually just say, oh yeah, you know, it's like beginning, like let's say going across the States with just harp and me me who was all like, oh no, we have to have exactly the same cello sound and exactly, you know, it's just kind of throw it out a little bit and not see what happens. I hate that phrase. It's so meaningless. Just abandon, let the shackles go and move into what I'm actually feeling, you know.
Julie, thanks for coming in. Thanks for picking all these tracks.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to play, Sound Out is next, I should say, with Ian McLean. And Julie, we're going to finish with The Great Gig in the Sky, which features Claire Torrey going for it. Have you ever sung like this? Can you sing like this, like Claire Torrey in this song?
I don't think I can. I don't know. Like, I'm not the person for that gig.
Well, if it becomes available, I'll recommend you. Julie Feeney, thanks a million.
You're very welcome.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.